WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the 1990s and early 2000s, Americans arguably lived through the greatest stretch of rampant prosperity the world had ever known. As we discovered, much of that prosperity was built on shifting sands. The economy collapsed and the Great Recession ensued. A common phrase then crept into our consciousness: the new normal. We heard it everywhere, perhaps to acknowledge reality and lessen the pain. But it also became a way of lowering economic expectations today and for years to come. At least one economist believes that we have capitulated to that pessimistic outlook too quickly. Philip Auerswald believes we must overcome the outdated narratives of fear and grasp the powerful momentum of progress. He emphasizes that the choices we make today will determine the extent and reach of what he calls the coming prosperity. That is the name of his book, in which he talks about how entrepreneurs are transforming the global economy. Philip Auerswald will be in town tomorrow to speak at noon at the Hilton Charlotte on behalf of the World Affairs Council Charlotte, and joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
He joins us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. Now, as I understand it, the coming prosperity that you see on the horizon is coming from third world and other underdeveloped economies around the world. And we've talked about this on this program before. And some of our guests have seen this as a sign of our impending doom in the United States. You don't see it that way. In fact, the first sentence of your book reads, "This is a book about the unparalleled possibilities of now." You see what is happening as an opportunity, don't you?
Well, I lived in China in 1986, briefly. I've had the opportunity to go back since. So that gave me a chance to see what global change, this moment that we're living through, looks like firsthand. Yeah, we can look at that as a threat if we want to. But from my standpoint, when the majority of the world's population joins the global economy, when most people in the world finally get to benefit from four centuries of technological and organizational change, when we see the greatest positive increase on a global scale in human well-being that's occurring in our lifetimes and that will only occur in our lifetimes because in some sense it's a one-time-only shift, yeah, I think that's something we should celebrate, and we should try to be part of it rather than be afraid of it.
Hmm. Is that why you say later in the book, we're all part of the traffic, a way to say that a rising tide lifts all boats, essentially?
Well, you know, that refers to a different point, which has to do with what I call paradoxes of prosperity.
Okay.
Foremost among these in the current imagination is climate change. But we're all part of the traffic means that when we look at resource issues, when we consider, for example, prospering countries as competing with us in the global economy for scarce resources and therefore putting pushing up their prices. We have to understand that we are, for example, in the energy market, 30% of that market. And so we're part of the traffic that drives up global prices. It's not just the new entrants on the margin that are responsible. I mean, we're in that market as well. So it's a different point, but it relates really to kind of having a clear-eyed view of the downside that we see of this change, the disruptions that we see.
So you mentioned that you went to China twice, once prior to their explosion of economic prosperity or their growing economic prosperity and since. What did you see that opened your eyes to all of this? What did you witness?
Well, I mean, I've been multiple times, okay. But you know what I witnessed is what you know. Again, most people in the world. When I say most people in the world, I'm talking about the 4 billion people who make less than $4 a day. That's the common experience. That's the modal experience. And I think we can get back to. I think should get back to what this means for the United States, because I know that listeners, you know, no doubt care a lot about that. And I do, you know, address that directly in the book. But you know, what I saw is what they have lived through. I think the most striking example actually is in China, but in Korea, where I was a couple of summers ago teaching a course in entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for an American to have experienced the same improvement in human well-being measured by per capita income, and I talk about limitations of that measure, but let's just go with that for the moment. So for an American to have experienced the same rate of change in a single lifetime as a 65-year-old South Korean, we would have had to be born in 1830. And for a Briton, you would have had to be born in 1700. So that means that somebody alive in South Korea today who is nearing retirement age has lived through 300 years of positive change in a single lifetime. So, you know, when you see these folks on the subway in Seoul, they look pretty stern and they look a little tired, some of them, particularly the ones in their 70s and 80s. And, you know, when you think about what they've been through, they've got good reasons.
Hmm. How many other economists would agree with you about your optimism or your what you see for the future?
You know, I think that there's almost no disagreement fundamentally. I mean, there's really no scope for disagreement about the basic facts that I'm describing in the book. I mean, you know, the only thing that I'm doing is I'm taking a longer time frame, both looking into the past and into the future. Mm-hmm. So my book is about global prosperity. And when I'm looking ahead and discussing the coming prosperity, I'm talking about over the next 25 to 40 years. And, you know, the fundamental facts are over that time period, over the last 200 years, we've seen two things happen: an explosion in global population, so we now know we're a population over 7 billion, and simultaneous with that, an explosion in global prosperity. And there's just no disputing those facts. So it's not really something that's sort of you know, potentially under contention.
You've called this the most exciting period in human history, and that the story of the 21st century isn't one of scarcity, but a thrilling adventure in prosperity and growth. Why then are we concentrating on doom and gloom? We've been concentrating on this for at least 4 years now, maybe longer.
Well, you talked about the Great Recession, right? And, you know, some notable economist, and I'm going to pick on Paul Krugman because he has a Nobel Prize and I'm sure he can handle it. have taken to comparing the Great Recession to the Great Depression. And, you know, from a statistical standpoint, it is true that this is, you know, the most significant recession since the Great Depression. But, you know, we really can't confuse the one with the other. The life expectancy in the United States in the 1930s was roughly the same as it is today in Ghana. 30% of people in the United States in the 1930s didn't have toilets. Or didn't have electric power. It was a new technology. About the same rate. So, you know, when we think about the you know, recent disruptions, it's an absolute insult to our grandparents to compare it to what they might have endured in the Great Depression. Now, you didn't make that comparison; other people do. But it's just a question of you know, putting recent disruptions into context. Now, let's talk about the financial crisis, right? I mean, what caused the financial crisis fundamentally, right? What was the fundamental cause?
Your teacher. You're asking me the question.
Okay. Did I study for I'm the asking exam? You the question, but I mean, giving the folks at home a chance to think about it.
All right. Well, I would guess bad mortgages put together by banks who were overzealous in taking advantage of the growing prosperity that we had, and it was a house of cards that ultimately collapsed.
Right. So, but at its basic level, too much borrowing. Right.
Okay. Right.
There had to be too much borrowing. And too much borrowing that was, you know, sort of – okay, if there's too much borrowing, what else does there have to be? Too much lending, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't have too much borrowing without too much lending. So where did the money come from to lend, right? Well, the answer to that is in a chapter of Alan Greenspan's book titled The Conundrum. It refers to testimony he gave to Congress, sort of 2006, I believe, where he described the inability of the Federal Reserve to really move mortgage rates, long-term interest rates, despite 17 straight increases of the federal funds rate. And so you know, why was the Fed why were the Fed's traditional instruments of policy that would have increased rates for borrowers, slowed lending, and dampened the bubble? Why were those so ineffective? Well, the reason is that there was this new pool of savings, this new pool of resources available to borrowers in the global economy that came from China and other newly wealthy countries. So the fact of the matter is, if you really look at the reasons for absolutely, criminal behavior, irresponsible behavior, opportunism, failure to enforce regulations, myopia, poor analysis, all that happened in the United States. But the real driving phenomenon behind the financial crisis was increased global savings, which was direct evidence and a consequence of increased global prosperity. So we have to really understand what's happening in our historical time period and not be blinded by short-term and transient phenomenon, which, believe it or not, this great recession will turn out to be.
If the Fed doesn't understand that, how can we?
Well, we understand now. I mean, it's in Alan Greenspan's book. So, you know, why don't we read the chapter, update what we know, and move on? Because, yeah, we didn't understand it in 2006. The people who did made a hell of a lot of money because they were able to look at Nassim Taleb and other folks like that who were, you know, shorting these products because they knew they were doomed. There were people who understood this. You know, why is it that economists, you know, persist in thinking things that, you know, fail to be correct, you know, as time proceeds? I mean, you know, people make mistakes. You know, this book is a very simple corrective. You know, we know short-term sells over long-term, negative sells over positive, exaggerated sells over moderated, right? Mm. Just generally speaking. Mm-hmm. So we have a surplus of short-term exaggerated negative stories that, you know, and you know, congratulations for NPR for and to this show for you know departing from that trend, but you know overall that's what sells. And in fact, there's, you know, some interesting evolutionary biology about, you know, what we are as animals, where we have a fight or flight reflex, and you know we have an appetite for things that might be threatening to us. So short term negative exaggerated stories sell. This is about the long term. This is about moderated. And this is this is about something that, as it turns out, is positive. And it's just fact.
And to illustrate your point, you do so in Chapter 5, because we just talked about the comparisons of the Great Recession to the Great Depression and how they really shouldn't be made, because there's no comparison. In Chapter 5, you talk about the Black Friday financial panic of 1869.
Exactly, yeah.
I remember hearing about that, but I can't tell you anything about what caused it or who was involved. I do know, as you point out, in 1869, that was also the year when the Transcontinental Railroad drove the Golden Spike and connected the country by a railway. That's something that we do remember because it had more lasting consequence.
Exactly.
So you're saying that we're focusing too much on short-term downturns and not enough on what will take us beyond these downturns.
I mean, you know, I met somebody once, actually, who was about 5 miles from the Woodstock Festival when it occurred in 1968, and they didn't go. You know, they didn't go. Maybe they thought it was going to be too crowded. You know, maybe it just wasn't their kind of people. But they probably should have gone. I mean, it was a big deal, and whatever they were doing that day probably wasn't worth missing that. Now, that's what's going on in the United States right now. You know, the Woodstock of our time is happening on a global basis. It's central narrative, not Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, but the mobile phone. And, you know, we should walk over and join what is the greatest party that human history has ever seen and be part of it.
All right, let me take a break. We'll come back to that, because you say the mobile phone is the most important technical device since fire. We're coming right back with Philip Auerswald, economist and author of The Coming Prosperity on Charlotte Talks. on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Neighborhood Theater, presenting Zappa Plays Zappa, February 5th, 8 p.m. Dweezil's band hits the road playing Frank Zappa favorites. Tickets at 704-358-9298 or neighborhoodtheater.com. And Hendrick Honda Hickory, offering new and certified pre-owned Hondas to the Charlotte Metro and Western North Carolina area on Highway 70 in Hickory and at hendrickhondahickory.com. The North Carolina eugenics program ended in 1974 after decades of forced sterilization of citizens. Former Governor Mike Easley formally apologized for the actions of state leaders, but reparations efforts have so far failed. Well, that issue has once again raised the question of whether today's generation has an obligation to right the wrongs of previous generations, and we take a look at that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, as part of our Mind and Body series, more than 5 million Americans suffer from Alzheimer's, but efforts to find new treatments for the disease have been disappointing. The ongoing battle against Alzheimer's disease.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Philip Auerswald, economist, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University, and author of The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy. He will be in town tomorrow to speak at the Hilton Charlotte for the World's Affairs Council Charlotte. Information about that at noon on our website at WFAE.org. So just prior to the break, you talked about the mobile phone, that we ought to get involved in what's happening with the mobile phone overseas, because you have said that the mobile phone is the most important piece of technology since fire. What should we be doing overseas? How should we be getting involved in this? Because, you know, we have, what, four carriers here, and they all cost a fortune.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not going to talk about mobile phone service in the United States and the constraints on it. And you know, I do mention the transistor radio maybe as the one intermediate one. And that just has to do with powerful technologies that made it to the village level on a global basis. You know, we talk about the internet, a wonderful technology. In no way, shape, or form has it made it on a global basis to the village level. So mobile telephony is the fastest, the most rapidly spreading technology in human history. But it's also the most powerful. So, you know, and as many people have noted, you know, The phone that you have in your pocket today has more computing power than NASA engineers had in 1969 when we sent people to the moon. So mm-hmm. so when you have that type of technology that's accessible on a global basis, what does that do? The problem is that we tend to put it in a framework of our own kind of experience where, you know, there's an ATM, you know, if not on every corner, then on every other corner. You know, we have infrastructure that allows for transport at relatively low cost, all kinds of services that we take for granted. So the mobile telephone is a way that, you know, we can find people if we're meeting them and we've missed a connection and we can keep in touch and so forth and so on. On a global basis, the mobile phone is the infrastructure backbone to deliver the services of the 20th century, be they banking, health. It's a way to provide this sort of level of comforts and some sort of connection to the technological possibilities of the 21st century, and it becomes this avenue for delivering all kinds of services, not just voice. So when, you know, you referred to the railway, I mean, we all know, you know, from watching however many Westerns and most recently Rango, and, you know, that what happens when you build a railway is, yes, the railway moves people. But what else does it do? Every place that the railway stops, it creates tremendous economic opportunity. Towns build themselves around railway stations. And so there's all this secondary economic activity that happens once you have a railway. Well, you know, mobile phones are the sort of metaphorical railways or interstate highway systems or whatever you want to think about in the 21st century. And it's all of the services that will be built around mobile over the next 20 or 30 years, but really over the next five, and it's happening. It's happening as we speak. That are going to transform lives for the majority of the world's population. It's going to be really stunning to watch, and it already is.
And you, your book is about entrepreneurs and how they can take advantage of this. In part, it's about that. So, if you're an American and you're sitting here and you have an entrepreneurial bent, what would you suggest people do to take advantage of this burgeoning technology in places where they've had nothing up until now? And one of the places you reference is Afghanistan, for crying out loud, with regard to the mobile phone.
Yeah, well, that's right. I'm sure all of our listeners have heard the story of Roshan since we've been hearing about Afghanistan for more than a decade. And Roshan is the biggest story in Afghanistan for the last decade. If you haven't heard of Roshan, that's because it's a good news story. It's a story about how Afghans now don't have to walk 700 miles to make a phone call. But in fact, now today in Afghanistan, thanks to Roshan, more people have access to mobile telephony than know how to read or write. That's pretty significant innovation. I haven't traveled to Afghanistan. I've heard from multiple people firsthand that this sort of phenomenon of the impact on people's daily lives of mobile telephony in Afghanistan, is at least as great as the things we read about every day in the newspaper. And in fact, a poll taken in Iraq, about 2008, I cited in my book, noted that Iraqis saw a more positive benefit in their lives from mobile telephony than they did from the changes in governance that had occurred over the previous 5 years. So, this is a huge phenomenon. Now, for the United States, now I'm so glad you asked that question. Let me start with something. We've just had this whole sort of fiscal cliff. I hope your listeners will forgive me if I call it a charade playing out here in Washington, D.C. But what really matters for the fiscal future of the United States is actually delivering the services that we have promised to deliver more efficiently and a lower cost at a high and with a higher value and quality. And so let's talk about Medicare. We just discussed mobile telephony, mobile services, mobile health services on a global basis. But these same technologies actually have tremendous power in the United States. If the Obama administration was to do one thing in the next 4 years, and I'm not joking about this, I'm absolutely serious, just a single thing, the most important thing the Obama administration could do would be to create a regulatory environment and a procurement environment, and this includes the VA, which I'll get to in a moment, to enable the delivery of health services via mobile devices on a national scale. And what that would do is it would allow seniors who are now being brought into hospital for very high-cost care, end-of-life care, so that they die, as my father did, alone in the middle of the night, connected to machines, when with the delivery of mobile health care services, they could be in their homes more comfortable and arguably living longer than under the current very high-cost system. So just focusing on reducing the cost of end-of-life care by providing health care through mobile service delivery is the one thing that could turn the curve on Medicare expenditures and is the most plausible way to ensure the long-term fiscal health of the United States of America.
How do you know that?
And we do that. How else within any other industry? I mean, just by analogy, we know that, right? In any other industry, what has shifted costs is using technology and new modes of organization to work around incumbents that resist change. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, Google didn't ask IBM's permission or Netscape's permission to do what it did. Right. So we have to invent around the current system. And the way to invent around the current system isn't to try to reform hospital care or focus excessively on shifting the burden of costs in an inefficient, bloated system. It's to create a parallel system that can disrupt the existing system based on entrepreneurship and technology, lower cost, bend the curve on Medicare and ensure the fiscal future of the United States. There is no other way in the long run to make this work other than by using technology and increased efficiency. So this is, you know, how many entrepreneurial opportunities are created in the United States? This is just within the United States. I'm not talking about globally, but it's just a simply an understanding of where we are in terms of our technological future. Now, that was a lengthy answer focused on the United States. There are also ways to connect with global opportunity that we can get to.
Well, just since healthcare is such a major topic of conversation in this country and has been for several years now, and it is a key factor in our economy and our economic future. What do we have to do? How many people are on this page with you? Are there entrepreneurs that you know about? Are there big companies that you know about? Are there governmental people that you know about who are on this page of creating this parallel healthcare system using technology?
You know, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, I was at a 3-day meeting in California, basically, a bunch of Silicon Valley folks and others and regulation and so forth. This is all happening. There's an enormous area of interest in mobile health delivery. There's a lot of focus on using big data, better analytics, ways to understand what actually works. From an entrepreneurship standpoint, there is a lot of interest. The problem is that the people who have the greatest ability to solve these challenges in terms of their entrepreneurial skills and in terms of their technical skills are focusing excessively on gadgets and not real system-changing innovations. My wife works at the VA hospital. A colleague of hers was piloting some use of mobile technologies within the VA. He's now part of a senior leadership team developing a strategy at the VA. 300,000 people work in the Veterans Administration. We have now 1 million servicemen and women who are going to be leaving the military, joining the general population over the next 2 or 3 years. These servicemen and women are disproportionately from rural areas. We have a great VA system. I'll vouch for it. I believe in the work my wife is doing, but it's not reaching people in rural areas the way it needs to. So just that alone is a huge opportunity. And who's on board with that? I mean, the VA understands this is a huge priority. The people in Silicon Valley understand this is a huge opportunity. And many people, I think anybody informed in government understands we need to bend the curve on Medicare expenditures and not just shift burdens as important as that may seem right now. So the consensus is all there. It's just a determination to work around the incumbent interests that will seek to block this change. This is just one of many, many examples. We can look at energy, healthcare, finance, education. I mean, the core, you know, aside from the opportunities of the 21st century that we discussed earlier, the other core theme of this book is the importance of entrepreneurship, not just in sort of creating jobs and bringing new technologies to market, which of course is extremely important, but also in maintaining the basic vitality of society by challenging the economic power and ultimately the political power of incumbents by creating new models that create tremendous value for society. So this is just one instance, but we could talk about education, we could talk about finance, and we could talk about energy, and we would see similar dynamics playing themselves out.
Philip Oswald is our guest. He's an economist at George Mason University and the author of The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy. And the global economy is kind of transforming the United States because we have had economic hegemony in this country for a pretty darn long time, for as long as most people alive today can remember. And yet you don't brush off the problems that we do face, and we do face problems because of the global economy. Things like veterans coming home who can't find work. Things like people whose paychecks have been declining since President Nixon was in the White House, the number of people on food stamps exceeding the population of California. So how do people like that who found themselves prosperous in the old economy, how do they benefit from this coming prosperity that you write about?
Well, the biggest mistake we make in the United States right now in thinking about our prospects and our recent history is by using the mid-1960s as a point of reference. This was a very wealthy country relative to the rest of the world, exceptionally wealthy in the 1960s. How did that happen? Well, there was something called World War II, Which killed 60 million people. So that's one 9/11 attack every day for about 30 years. That's a huge loss. And the other thing it did was destroy every major production center in the world except for the ones in the United States. So that global devastation was kind of good for us. It's not to say that we don't have tremendous institutions. It does not to say that we don't have a tremendous tradition of entrepreneurship and innovation. And I'm working right now in Washington, D.C. to celebrate that tradition. I believe it's vitally important and distinct in the United States. And it's not to say that we didn't have plenty of talent in this country pre-1945 ready to do amazing things. But what happened after 1945 was that we were in the singular position not only to provide goods and services to the rest of the world, which was struggling to get back on its feet, but also to attract the best talent from all over the world, which we did for 30 or 40 years. Everybody who could possibly make it to our shores and get United States citizenship did so. This was just an incredible, incredible era, but it was built upon global devastation. So that's not a normal point of reference. When countries like China, I mean, China was 30% of the world's economy for 500 years until 1830. And you can look up the history of the Opium Wars if you want to see an absolute travesty perpetrated in another country. You know, China absolutely being the victim in that case. And so China's decline, certainly self-generated, but also imposed from without, you know, began roughly in the 1830s, and by 1979, China was about 4% of the global economy. Now they're coming back. That is normal. That is a return to what has been the status quo through human history, where wealth is actually fairly evenly distributed around the planet. So when nothing changes, nothing about what I'm saying, will give somebody a job who doesn't have a job in the next 6 months. We are in a tremendous era of disruption in this country, and it is part of a global disruption. Looking ahead, however, it's an incredibly exciting time to be young. I have three daughters. I just think that there's just so much opportunity for them. And there's opportunities, everywhere in this country. But it's not to say that the transition isn't tremendously difficult.
Well, because your book is about entrepreneurship, not everybody is an entrepreneur. Not everybody thinks like one. Not everybody has the talent to be one or the drive to be one, it would seem to me. And it's a new way of thinking and working in this country because, as you say, from the 40s up, people worked for big corporations, corporations that were expected to take care of us until the day we died and give us nice pensions in retirement at age 65. And that's going away. So to be an entrepreneur requires a different mindset. Is the younger generation ready? Are they better at this than older generations? Are they being prepared for this kind of a world environment?
Well, I sure hope so. I mean, my first job was teaching in D.C. public schools. I've been a teacher and in education most of my life. Professional life, obviously. It may be the other important thing, aside from maintaining the fiscal health of the country in the future by doing the sorts of things we were talking about earlier, is to absolutely renew our determination to give our young people both a sense of the possibilities of their historical moment, a sense of excitement of the time that they're living in, but also the basic skills that they're going to need. And, it's not actually just about a set of tools. It's really about a mindset. And that mindset it's inherently collaborative. And it's one that really is about looking at what's out there, recombining, creating value for other people, and being flexible to do that on a regular basis throughout their lives.
Philip Auerswald, an economist and the author of The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Mm-hmm.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Man Travels, presenting the 30th Annual Travel and Cruise Show, Sunday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Charlotte Convention Center. Details at mantravels.com/show. Well, as part of the Mind and Body series, more than 5 million Americans suffer from Alzheimer's, but efforts to find new treatments for the disease have been disappointing. The ongoing battle against Alzheimer's disease, obviously part of a series that Diane Rehm and her folks are doing, and that will come your way in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Our guest today will be in town tomorrow to speak at the World Affairs Council Charlotte at the Charlotte Hilton. Information about that and how you can attend is on our website right now at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Also, you can contact us there or by phone, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323 or 800-603-WFAE. And we're coming right back.
The car served me through college, grad school. It moved me from Minneapolis to Portland, Oregon, and then Portland, Oregon to Augusta, Georgia. And the Lumina is still giving by putting my favorite programs on the air. It feels awesome. My name is Bethany, and I donated my car to public radio.
Your unwanted vehicle can support your favorite WFAE shows with the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program. Get details at WFAE.org. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Philip Auerswahl, our guest today, an economist and assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University in the Washington, D.C. area. He joins us from the studios at WAMU, and he's the author of The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy. If you've been listening for most of the hour, this sounds like very good news and very optimistic news, particularly in light of the kinds of conversations we've been having about the future of this country and where we are economically in the last 4 to 5 years. And you say you're not an optimist. You're just shorting fear.
Well, yeah. I mean, the best definition I can come up with for optimism is, just someone who's persistently late. And why would an optimist always be late? Well, an optimist says, it's about 20 minutes, to get from Fairfax into downtown D.C. Assuming there's no traffic, right? Mm. But there will be. So a pessimist is always early. Anything can happen. Have to be prepared at the airport 2 hours early, right? That's why people tend to sort of discount the views of so-called optimists and pessimists because they don't want to be rushing to the last minute and late, and they don't want to be waiting around at the airport for an hour. They pretty much rather be with the person who's going to get it right. I don't see this as being an optimistic book. I'm not particularly interested in being an optimist. The only thing I'm trying to do again is to correct for the imbalances that exist in the market for information. Not to say that there aren't plenty of other folks doing something similar to what I'm trying to do in this book. Peter Diamandis has a great book called Abundance that's really about technology futures. That's I think a great companion to The Coming Prosperity in the sense that he's talking about all the things that I don't even get into, the new technologies that will be transformative in the 21st century. I believe my argument holds even given existing technologies, but, it enhances it further. So there's other people making that, this sort of arguments I'm making. I'm definitely not alone. But it's essentially just a little bit of a counterpoint to the mostly, kind of uninformed negativity and in some sense, the deliberate misinformation given to the general public. Really requires some refutation.
Who's giving us this deliberate misinformation?
Well, there's. I'm prompted to make a connection that I usually don't make, except that you have a program tomorrow that's directly relevant. The reason I don't make it is a very uncomfortable subject of conversation. We have had for over a century a conversation about the dangers of growing populations. You know, it's deeply ingrained in our view of the world that we're threatened by increased population, and we talk about resource scarcity and so forth. Now, this story obviously goes back to Thomas Malthus. I talk about it in my book. You know, we can read an essay on the principle of human population, you know, that's a well-known story. What I'm referring to is when Malthusian theory was combined with Darwinism. Mm-hmm. And we had something called eugenics. And eugenics was really about how to scientifically manage the threat of growing populations. Now, eugenics was a way of thinking about managing the threat of human populations that you know was originated in the United Kingdom. It was very popular in the United States, it was only very suddenly discredited when World War II started, and obviously. We had some enemies who were famous proponents of eugenics. You know, this mentality of looking at other people as a threat is something that continues to be a significant part of our national narrative. And to be honest, it's right at the heart of our discussion about immigration. The groups that have been the most avid proponents of thinking about immigration as a threat draw their lineage directly from groups like zero population growth in the 1970s that were concerned about the environmental impacts of immigration. And I talk about John Tanton in my book. John Tanton has been a tremendously effective social entrepreneur. Was the founder or was involved in the founding of a number of organizations that have been in the lead in creating fear about what will happen to this country if we have increased immigration. My colleague Tyler Cowen and I at George Mason, we both recognize and understand, the demonstrable benefits that immigration has created in the past in the United States. But what's more, it's that immigrants, the newest Americans, are our collaborative advantage. These are our points of connection to the global prosperity I was talking about earlier. I mean, this could be, a scientist in Palo Alto, an entrepreneur in Charlotte, who is from India or who is from Kenya. But it could also be literally the person who is trimming your bushes or bussing tables. People who are in this country as immigrants have shown tremendous tenacity to get here, and almost without exception have excellent networks back home that we could be using, each one of us, not just individually, but as communities, as universities, as this tremendous base of relational capital to mine to connect to opportunities in the 21st century. So our whole discussion about immigration is infused with fear that's connected to a century-long debate about people as a threat rather than people as our fellow human beings. And their relationships as an opportunity. So, it's a long story, but we have to really look carefully at where stories come from and what people are telling us and why they're telling it.
You're making it sound like an American problem. There's no question that we do have exactly what you described in the last thing you were talking about, and this kind of xenophobic outlook. But isn't that shared across the globe? Don't we all have fear of the other? And if that's true, because you reference all these entrepreneurs and innovators in other countries who are natives of those countries, who are climbing up the social and economic ladders and helping their countries in the process, are they open to outside entrepreneurs coming in to do that? Or is it easier for them to do it because they know the system, they know the culture, they know the people, they are trusted because they are not the other?
I got to know a young guy named Ben Lyon a few years ago. Trying to remember where he graduated from college, but Ben wasn't a Harvard Business School graduate. Ben was a young guy from a good school, good small college, who was interested in mobile telephony and mobile banking. He got involved in something called Frontline SMS. You can Google it, look it up. Tremendous toolkit that has enabled innovations, open source toolkit available innovations of the types I'm talking about, services over mobile. And, this is a nonprofit organization, and Ben was involved in helping with the mobile banking. Now Ben is in Kenya. He is the founder of an organization called Kopo Kopo. Kopo Kopo is a real innovator in mobile banking, and Kenya is the global leader in that. There's something called M-Pesa, which has more agents in Kenya than we have Wells Fargo terminals in the United States. This is a tremendously far-reaching and disruptive and positive innovation in Kenya. And Kopo Kopo is sort of building on that on that innovation. This is Ben's life. There are any number of Americans all over the world. I see them on a constant basis. I mean, young people who are traveling, who are connecting, who are finding opportunities, you know, in every corner of the world. Everybody listening here probably knows a young person who is, you know, either, you know, working in a sort of a learning capacity, an exchange capacity, or else actually, you know, actively building a venture or helping to build a venture someplace else in the world, be it Latin America, Africa, Asia. I mean, it is a big, big world, and young people are out all over the place, and they are finding opportunities, and they are being welcomed by fellow entrepreneurs. About xenophobia, yes, absolutely. But we have to be different. I mean, this is a global phenomenon, but we have to be different. It is in our national character. I mean, the two things that define us, aside from our basic rights encoded in our founding documents, is our entrepreneurial spirit. The fact that we are a country of immigrants. These are the two things that defined us. And we have to make those renew our commitment, not only to our basic rights, but also to our values of entrepreneurship and openness to immigration.
As the world economy adjusts, and as these underdeveloped nations become more developed and their standards of living rise, what does that mean for Western nations like the United States, who have long depended on maintaining our standard of living in part on cheap labor coming from overseas and the prices of products and goods coming from overseas that are cheaper because the labor is cheaper? If their standard of living is rising, that means that their salaries are rising, which means the cost of goods will rise. How do we maintain our standard of living?
Okay, so basically everything and this is survey-based, and this is, you know, we can look it up and do research about it. The modal perception of the rest of the world in this country is about 20 years out of date. This notion of the, you know, they are rising things in process. I mean, a lot of this is done. You go to Shanghai, you go to Seoul. These are fully developed 21st century, you know, wealthy places. In terms of labor costs, the best thing that can happen to workers in the United States, as far as reshoring of jobs, is actually for wages to go up in places like China. But the real challenge, and what has gotten a lot of news attention, and rightly so, isn't actually that manufacturing jobs went to China. In the 10 years. Between 1995 and 2005, the United States lost about 3 million jobs. During that, 3 million manufacturing jobs. During that same interval, China lost 12 million manufacturing jobs. So that there's a net loss in manufacturing jobs that's driven by increased automation and efficiency. My colleagues Eric Bernalson and Andrew McAfee have called the race against the machine in their book. This is getting a lot of attention, and rightly so, because this is the real trend we have to understand. I talk about it in my book as well. It's in chapter one of my book, talking about a early prediction along these lines. So what has really been disrupting our economy, what is really challenging us now in terms of job creation, jobless growth, isn't the fact that other people have been stealing our jobs. What it has to do with long-term, century-long trends of increased automation and efficiency in industry after industry, now hitting professors, by the way, also lawyers, and we need to be even as creative in finding new modes of work and new ways of creating value. That's the real challenge. That's the thing we need to worry about.
Yeah, because if the population of the world is increasing, and that's not a bad thing, because you said it's not a bad thing, and automation is increasing, robots are increasing and taking away jobs, and as you mentioned, even professors are not immune to this. People are now taking courses all over the world online conducted by one professor. What does that mean? Won't that mean fewer jobs for more people?
What it means is time to get creative. I mean, do I have the answer? Do I know what the economy of the future is going to look like? Do I know exactly how people are going to create value and how they're going to what sort of livelihoods they will have? I don't know. Who in 1970 did you see the iPhone? I mean, did you see Twitter? No. I mean, it is a constant process of reinvention and collaboration, creating new combinations, testing them out, so forth and so on. We have a greater base of technological possibilities today than would have been imaginable even 40 years ago. Mm. We have 4 billion people who were disconnected from the global economy who are now creative, who are now connected. They can bring their talents to trying to find new solutions. In fact, my next book is going to be titled Repurpose, and it's going to be about, you know, facing this challenge. We have to understand what our capabilities are individually, as business entities, as regions, and clearly in some sense as a nation. And we have to repurpose those skills to find the new opportunities that exist. This is not an easy challenge. This is the core thing to worry about. But it's also a core thing to be excited about. But at least when we talk about this notion of creating productive livelihoods for everybody in this country and understanding how they will be available for everywhere in the world, this is really something worth thinking about and worth working on.
And you talk in the book about the aspirations so many people have about coming to America, and you use Simon and Garfunkel's song America. They come to look for America. And in the end of the book, you say that if America is truly exceptional, it is because America is not a place. It is an idea that changes, adapts, and evolves, and that the coming prosperity suggests that we look for the next America. And that won't be a place. It'll be using what we know. I'm paraphrasing here and putting words in your mouth, using what we know to benefit the world. Is that accurate?
It's absolutely accurate. It's absolutely accurate. We have just such an exciting moment here in this country to create that next America. I see my kids as ready to be part of it. I have a sense that your listeners are probably ready to be part of it too. So I think we should just get to work.
And we don't have a choice, do we?
We don't have a choice. We don't have a choice.
Philip Auerswald, an economist and assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University, and author of The Coming Prosperity, which, by the way, is written for general audiences, not for economists. The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you.